is December 10th, and we're going to start the chapter 5, section B, which is on page 49. It's called Existence of All Buddhas, Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and Numberless Beings. And does everyone see that?
Mm-hmm.
And it's very useful that that there's this last point, numberless beings, because in a way that's what this is about, the numberless beings that are our life, which is the existence of all Buddhas. So notice he starts off by talking about two different ways of understanding this existence. The first is theoretical and logical, and the other is actual. And by actual,
What about actual interpretation?
Yes. So by actual, he means experiential. So it's not something that we think up, but what is true in our experience and what we actualize. This is what we mean by experiencing practice. So this is the existence of Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and numberless beings, which means, in another way you could say, it means the existence of our life. But that's okay. We'll start where we start, which is, he starts with something simple that you're all familiar with, Kanon, or that's Kuan Yin, or Kanzeon, or Kanjizai. Different ways of talking about the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. So, on one sense, there's the statement, as he says, that there's no such thing as concrete, it's really our compassionate mind. But he says that's only half true. It omits the actual because there's an underlying fact, as he says in the next paragraph, that we all become, he says, kanon. I would say we all are and we all reveal this bodhisattva compassionate action in our life of being this, of manifesting this. Which means, as he puts it, as you all know, hearing and seeing the suffering of others. There's actually two forms of, well, there's many forms, but there's two forms that are primary, at least in the Japanese tradition, which is the kanji, one is hears the cries of suffering or sees the suffering of others. He interprets it to hear others' anxieties intuitively, which is to be this connectedness and with others as the world and responding, which is what the Heart Sutra is all about. The Heart Sutra starts off Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva doing deep prajna paramita, clearly saw emptiness of all conditions and thus relieves suffering of others. So, that's he saying. So I'll just say one more word and then I'll let you start saying the very next, without exception, we all have this spirit, this sympathetic. It's only because we believe self-centered stories of who we are and who we're not. We could say dualism of mutual self and others, exclusiveness, that we don't see what's called for. We don't see what it is to be a bodhisattva. We believe our story and what we want to say and what we don't want to say and what should and shouldn't. Then we lose touch, as he puts it, with this intuitive feeling. And therefore, what Zazen does, what practice does, is allows us to awaken our inherent sympathetic spirit. Inherent. What does inherent mean? Someone? Yeah, something that comes with your being who you are. Meaning you don't have to create this. You don't have to go to special training to learn how to do this. It's inherently who you are if we're not caught up in self-centeredness. It's who we are even when we are, but we just have are out of touch with it, so to speak. It's, you know, when you're, we all came out of wombs in some form or other, and we, sometimes we needed a little help starting to breathe, but most of us were able to start to breathe because inherently that comes with being human. Sometimes we have problems with it, but no one taught us how to breathe. Not that I know of. I don't remember seeing that with either of my children when I was there, though I did see them having to be suctioned out when, if there was something blocking their lungs and mouth, throat. I don't know of anyone here that is listening to me that needed to be taught how to breathe. Sometimes we have illnesses that cause problems with it, etc., etc. That's what he means by our inherent sympathetic spirit, or I'll say our inherent bodhisattva spirit. Our inherent ability to be compassionate, though we can refuse it. So.
Now, what if at the very end, towards the end of that, oh, let's see, that one, two, three, fourth paragraph?
Yeah.
And it, you know, he says, then it helps us to awaken our inherent sympathetic spirit. As a means to this end, Buddhism teaches us to do charitable work. This is a theoretical interpretation of Kuan Yin Bodhisattva. So does that mean that's less something that, if it's theoretical, it's not so good or something? That's
it's terrible? Another one. Not so good, but that it's just one side.
I'm sorry? What?
It's one side of it. Theory is theory, but if all you do is theory, here, if I read a book, Shoujo, you know about this very well. If I read a book all about how to swing golf clubs, and I say, okay, I know how to play golf, you even laugh at me. That's what he's talking about.
Well, he says it in the second paragraph. For every theory, there's an underlying fact. Theory and fact must exist simultaneously.
Yes.
I'm interested in this intuition. I can just use an example in my life. When I go into Champaign County Nursing Home, there's certain people that I'm not assigned to or anything, but I'm just attracted to. And I become friends with them. And it's just something I feel. They're bodhisattva. And maybe they're, you know, intuitively we interact somehow. Does that make sense?
Yeah. In a way, you could say all of practice is to open ourselves up to what we always are, but Not that we have to learn to be something new, but we need to cease doing what gets in the way of us being who we are.
And this just happens naturally.
Well, the doing what ceasing to do what gets in the way doesn't seem natural often. It seems very difficult and artificial because of how used to how much we're used to doing what gets in the way, how true self-centeredness seems to us. See? Or as he says at the end of the very next paragraph, some people cannot accept this interpretation because they think there is only one life, meaning there is only their self-centered identification of who that we are or they are. So therefore, using words like eternal life to imply life after life or to imply being after being of myriad beings that we are at any particular moment, which are not mutually exclusive, or if I say it another way, myriad lives and myriad bodhisattvas right now here, as long as we hold on to the one self-centered story, then we have to keep resisting that, and therefore we don't see or sense that. See? In a way, if we look at the beginning of this paragraph, as long as we have Kanon's virtue, in one sense, is Kanon the same as you? Not so, but it's also not so. Is Kanon different from you? Not so, but it's also not so. So, see, so in a way, this is to sort of grapple and chew on what he says in this paragraph, in this page, and what we've talked about is, in a way, is our ongoing practice whenever we notice caught in self-centered dream, if I use that expression, which you're all very familiar with. So that's the sense of what he means, how he's talking about Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and myriad beings. So, but let me stop here and see if you have more to say before I go on.
So with Kanon, or Zayon, or Bodhisattva.
You have to speak up. I missed what you were saying.
Okay. Well, Kanon, or Kanzeon Bodhisattva, is really the activity of compassion, and so that there's no actual, you know, in a way, no person doing this stuff and taking credit for it, but just the compassion and the activity of that.
Why is there no Kanon person? What is a person?
Well, a person is some kind of identity which we pretend that we
have. It's fine. It's fine to have an identity when you're playing golf as someone with a, let's say, an 80 handicap, then you're just being an 80 handicap golfer. Great. And or an 80 par, whatever you call that, I don't know enough. That's who you are. But as long as you don't hold on to that, then you can be completely that. Because your Kanon doesn't keep you from being Shoujo. Shoujo Kanon is exactly who you can be.
Not can be, but are.
Well, are and still can be or can refuse to be.
Yeah.
Or seem not to be. So, see, we want to get in, when we use the word actual, we get into trouble. That gets back to this one life. See, we don't want to believe in this eternal or myriad beings, numberless beings.
Can we reinterpret the word actual to mean living?
But what do you mean by living? So you're still going to play the same game of what you say is living or what's not living.
Well, actual is how others see you and how you see yourself. And
yeah, but if you say, who is yourself?
I am you.
Notice that's what he gets at. The very next paragraph, he further clarifies this. He talked where at the top of page 50, he says, Manju, or that's Manjusri, or Manju or Manjusri is our enlightened wisdom, and Fugen is our complete compassionate mind, which evolves from this enlightened wisdom. So, therefore, our means yours and mine, meaning that, so, are you actually Manjusri? Are you actually Fugen? Fugen is Samantabhadra, is the Sanskrit name of Fugen.
You know, when I was reading this, I was thinking, when a person dies and you go to a funeral and say it's your mother, someone comes up to you and says, well, you know, your mother lives on in your heart. And so as long as you remember her, she's still alive. And I was thinking that when I read this, I was thinking, well, maybe that is what he's meaning by carrying on the traditions of Mom's group, that we honor his example.
Well, I'll take it a step further. When you act in ways that your mom did to feed a child or to help soothe someone who's suffering, as your mom did with you, you're not acting like your mom. You are enacting your mom. You're being your mom. Your mom is living out in that action. That's you and your mom together soothing a child.
Well, then that's easier to understand.
See?
Yeah, I think that's right. Sometimes I find myself moving and doing things that just like my mother did. And I don't know where I got that, but I notice that that's happening a lot. That's so scary because I don't always like my mother.
Don't believe your self-centered likes and dislikes.
Yeah, I know those things come up anyway. But yeah. I know what you're saying.
And how you feel, Shoujo? The older I get, the more similarities I see between mom and dad.
We all experience that. Yeah.
I thought maybe for me anyway, a way to look at this. We can say that I'll use myself as an example. I can say that I am a particular expression of human nature, of the human race, but I would never call myself the human race. And in that same sense, I have the capacity to be a particular expression of Kanon, but I wouldn't necessarily call myself Kanon.
Uh-huh. Yeah. See, this is encouraging us to see what it is to be bigger than who we normally think we are in our self-centered, narrow perspective. So that we're not blinded and caught up by our self-centered likes and dislikes, dreams and daydreams and stories. Because otherwise we use those to punish ourselves sometimes, punish others, cause suffering, or trumpet ourselves and blow ourselves up egotistically. See? That, I mean, this is what he's trying to deal with and share with us in this chapter. Not that you have to believe anything else, but at least to start being bigger than your narrow vision of who you are and who you are not. You don't need any of these names. If you want, you know what? You could talk about from a Christian point of view and saying, I am living the heart of Jesus, or being Mary's compassion towards all children, or whatever words you use. I'm not a Christian, so I might be saying things clumsy there might be more skillful ways to say this. But this is what he's talking about.
Well, from a Christian perspective, the image of Mary is fairly similar to what we think of as the qualities of Amalekitesvara. That's where they get the Sacred Heart.
Yes.
What was I going to say? It doesn't matter.
I have a hard time translating some of the Christian images, etc., over. Like the Sacred Heart of Jesus, I never could understand that. And all I saw was a bloody dagger going through a heart dripping blood.
Well, I can't help you with that. You'll have to work on that one.
It's not worth it.
Just images people just made up, you know.
Yeah.
No. For some people, they see their life serving as embodying this that they learned. And the guidelines and what they learned are ways to encourage them to open up beyond the narrow confines of likes and dislikes, self and not self. And in that sense, it does enable that to live. It doesn't matter what name you give it, if you call it compassion of Canaan, or compassion of Jesus, or compassion of Mary, or compassion of Muhammad, or, you know, or Krishna's serving, or go on. I don't care the name you use. The different names are skillful, or sometimes they're not so skillful. The question is, do they enable us to go beyond the narrow self dualism or self-centeredness or the greed and anger, or do they keep us locked into that and justify all sorts of harming and suffering? That's what's important from what I want to talk about, what I think in terms of our practice.
Daniel?
Yes.
I remember what I was going to say. Finally. You could even take a strictly scientific perspective on this. I'm sure you've seen the studies with, you know, brain scans are very popular in neuroscience right now.
Yes.
And they found that, you know, when someone is sad or happy or in pain, certain areas of the brain are activated.
Yes.
And they've noticed that when someone sees someone.
Yes.
If they're paying attention.
Mirroring.
Or happy.
Uh-huh.
In pain, those same areas of their brain.
Yes. Neuromirroring.
Tuning forks of the same pitch. Yeah. You strike one and the other one resonates.
Yeah. Yes. And it's very interesting that this isn't only humans. Monkeys do it, and other beings have this mirroring. It's, in a way, it's often overridden by our fears and our anger and greed, but when we don't allow those overriding habits to get in the way, this can come forth because we are multiple beings. We are in this limitless universe. There are numberless beings, and these are who we are. The eternal life means numberless beings that we are, and I would say that we are right now. And yet, we have to take care of our life and do our practice or function or part in order to do this. If he could say, that we can be these both, the Bodhisattva Manjushri and the Bodhisattva Phugan or Samantabhadra, meaning the enlightened wisdom and compassionate mind, how could we be two different Bodhisattvas? And yet we can. Now notice at the end of this chapter, at the bottom of the page 50, he goes through, he brings up a philosophical, as he calls it, a set of categories of beings. I mean, it's just a way of talking about it. It's just another way of talking about it. It doesn't exclude anything. But that's there to further enable us to go beyond self, or as he puts it, for the self to swallow up the limitless universe, and in a way the limitless universe swallow up the self. Or be swallowed in the self, or by the self, or whatever way we talk about it. So you see where he goes on to talk about. But I'm talking too much, and I'm sure you have all sorts of points you want to bring up.
I have a question. You said about, in that paragraph about the limitless universe must be swallowed by the self.
Yes.
Were there no universe, no self could exist. Were there no self, no universe could exist. Can you say something about that to help clarify that? Or that sounds a little kind of, you know, like you're trying to figure it out, but you're not supposed to figure it out, and yet you're supposed to see how that's supposed to work in a kind of, I don't know, it's just kind of, the logic there kind of, it just gets over the edge there. To me, anyway.
Well, in a sense, the self and universe are, you could say, two facets of our life, but they're two facets that we dance with. Because the self is our ability to function and dance with the universe, but if we hold on to ourself, then in a sense we miss the universe. It's only if we can open up the self that we could be the self, which is the whole universe, and therefore can dance in all the different, places that the universe manifests in our life, in all the different ways. You can chew on this for a while, and we can.
That is something to chew on. That's for sure.
See, what does it mean to be swallowed by the self? How is this becoming emancipated? What are we emancipated from? What is the result of being emancipated? See, notice that just before this he talks about complete emancipation. Now, remember that this builds on this previous discussion or categorization of all these different realms of beings, many of which are realms which involve, you could say, suffering and self-centeredness, especially since the categories start with, at least the way he arranges them, they're not mutually exclusive, nor is it any sort of progression, but he starts with hell realms and hungry ghost realms. Now, some of you might know what some of these realms, how these realms are interpreted. I mean, he explains it, extreme ignorance and strong ego consciousness and intense suffering is a hell realm. And on the other side is contentment and fullness of Buddha light as the, other side. So, hungry ghosts, you know about, is always searching, wanting something, but never being able to be satisfied. So you're suffering the pangs of hunger, always trying to fulfill it, and always facing the frustration and never being satisfied. And you can go on from there, to some of these other realms. We could talk about them, but I don't know that you need me to talk about them. Unless you bring it up. So this, in a sense, this whole chapter is an attempt to, broaden our existence to extend in the direction of all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas that we can be and are, both theoretically and in actuality. Anyone want to say anything?
Well, I was looking at this. Although in that same paragraph about the swallowing of the self and the universe and the universe, says, although Buddhism teaches that the world is an enormously big place, its primary concern is to teach complete emancipation. And to me that says emancipation from clinging to self rather than eliminating or obliterating the self completely.
Yeah, and you could say even more emancipation from suffering and harming. That's really the primary point. Emancipation from suffering and harming, or you could say from the other side, from desires and sorrows, if I use that word.
But isn't when we cling to the self that there's suffering arises almost immediately, just with that particular...
Yes. Sometimes we only see the, we don't see any clinging to self. What we only see is the suffering side.
Yeah.
So there isn't, they're so intertwined.
Yeah, it's very difficult to see that clinging and, but.
Yeah. Because it seems natural.
Yeah.
That's why we practice. That's why we sit zazen.
Mm-hmm. Notice it's not as hard to see it in others.
What's not as hard to see in others?
It's not as hard to see clinging in others as it is to see it in
others. You're so right.
You mean it? You mean it's not so hard to judge others?
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, but that judgment is often done in the service of our self-centeredness.
Yeah, it's a form of clinging.
Yeah, it's a form of elevating self and putting down others, or speaking of the faults of others.
Yeah.
Making ourselves righteous.
So we're supposed to get a whole bunch of snow. You want some snow, Ganyo?
No, we're getting a whole bunch of rain. I'm satisfied with the rain.
We don't have to shovel rain.
Well, you sometimes do if it's going in places where you don't want it to.
Yeah, like your basement or something.
So, but we need the rain, and I'm glad to get it. Actually, we have snow in the mountains, but I don't live in the mountains, and I'm not... There are people who love to go up to the mountains when there's snow so that they can ski and snowboard and
just play in the snow.
Go snowshoeing and on, I don't remember what those machines are called, the snowmobiles.
Yeah, snowmobiles.
So there's lots of people here who do that. They go up to the Sierras, and the Sierras have lots of snow this year. And it's a lot of fun for those who do it, but I really am not interested at the moment.
Yeah, did you say it's snowing there in Springfield now?
No, no, it's going to start Friday night and snow all through Friday or Saturday.
Yeah.
So you might get 6 or 7 inches.
Mm.
I may not make it to the Zen Center.
You might not, yeah.
I will send Dharma Talk to Shoujo, and he could play it. If not, he could play last week's. That's okay. But I have one.
Well, Shoujo can give a talk.
Yes.
He's done it before.
Yes.
No, I've never given.
Yes, sort of a little one. Yes.
So, one of the nice things about doing Sunday is that it's in a virtual realm, and I don't have to worry about the snow.
That is good.
Yeah.
Okay, anything else on this chapter?
Well, I was wondering, we have time. I don't want to take up...
Yes, we have time.
He says he once visited a Zen group meeting where the altar had been replaced by a scroll depicting mountains and water. This was supposed to be a scientific, in quotes, approach to Buddhism. So is he being a little sarcastic or something?
Yes.
Yeah. Being opinionated.
You can't do anything like that, right?
You can do whatever you want. Joko had altars where she put rocks, and other people have done the same. You could do whatever you want. However, don't get stuck in any particular in any particular form. Then, fine.
Genio, this is Lynn, and I have to admit, when I read that sentence, I was a little taken aback because in my meditation room, I have a huge Chinese scroll that has mountains and people. flowers. I had to think for a moment there, and I thought, no, that doesn't have a scientific meaning to me. So I figured I was okay.
You're okay, even if it has a scientific meaning. But see,
it's not a problem until we start believing the rock is holy.
Well, no, if you believe this way is better and the other way is worse, then, you know, if you want a scroll, fine. Have mountains and rivers on a scroll and fine. Nice. But if we hold on to it, if we think this is a more scientific and less superstitious way, then we're getting in trouble. I mean, if you have issues with bowing and with Buddhas, fine. If it'll make it so that people who have difficulties with that can sit, fine. But he's trying to make it clear that if you see a Buddha on the altar, a Buddha image on the altar, don't believe that your idea of what it is. Don't get caught in your story.
Vast emptiness, nothing holy.
So, that's his point. And he has his own, you know, habits and predilections. I have no problem. No altar is fine. Having an altar is useful. There's myriad forms. Any other points that anyone wants to bring up?
One more thing that he's at the very last sentence of the last paragraph there. I am convinced, however, that the religious aspect of Buddhism is going to grow in the Western world. So this religious aspect, is he talking about, like, ceremonies and
No. Notice just the sentence before that, he talked about...
Oh, philosophy and stuff.
Yes, he says... It's either a philosophy or a discipline, meaning, oh, it's a way to get, it's a means to get certain powers and strength. And he says, if you're just using it in that utilitarian way or in that kind of theoretical way, then he says, in a sense, it loses its power to touch your life and to connect your life. That's the word religion. That's what he's trying to get at, that there's this actualizing, not just this theoretical, but this actualizing is what this practice is. That's what he means by religious. Oh, that's how I see. Now, remember, this is a translation from another language. So, yes. In other words, you could read all the books you want about Zen and you could have lots of understanding about all the different forms and lineages and rules and all these things, but if that's all you've got, then that's just philosophy or theory. And if you're saying every time you do Zen Zazen, that this is so that you can do and have this and that and that and this and get rid of that and this, then it becomes a means to an end and it's just another way to, what should I say, enhance self.
Mm-hmm. You're treating the practice as though or something, some other kind of like yoga or
right.
Exercise or...
Right. If you're caught up, Shoujo, when you're swinging a golf club in the idea that I'm going to get such and such results on this swing, then that much you're interfering with the swinging of the golf club and the playing of golf. So, okay. Next week, we won't have a class. We will resume the week after, which is, I don't remember the date.
It's on the 21st, so what would that be?
So the 24th. I expect to be back unless something happens, which of course the universe is unforeseeable, but that's what we'll aim for. And when we do meet then, we will begin chapter 6, Mutual Attraction Between Buddhas and Sentient Beings, which in a way we've already started to talk about. So, good night. Thank you all.
Good night.